This is Reality Proves Possibility, an exploration of human ingenuity. This is Reality Proves Possibility. I'm Michael Pearson, and I'm pleased to be here with all the new friends, Tony Annette and Laura Segafredo, who have been working on a number of key issues which we will explore in terms of transforming business and the economy. Their podcast is called A Moral Revolution, and we're going to check in with them on their ambitions and how they're doing. But first, Laura and Tony, thank you for being here. What's your reaction to the statement, reality proves possibility, and we can do better than this? Laura.
All right. Thank you for having us, Michael. It's great to be here. It's great to be here with Tony. Reality proves possibility. So my conviction is that reality is just one of the many possibilities, and that if we have the courage to be imaginative and really, really use our imagination, we can not just envision, but build different realities, a reality that's perhaps more in alignment with some of the things that we think are important, whether it be social justice or care for our earth, etc. So that's how I think about reality. Just one of the many possibilities. I don't want to be limited by reality in imagining different ones.
Great. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you, Michael. I will take a slightly historical perspective and argue that the reality of the economy as it existed during the 30 golden years from 1945 to 1975 gives us the possibility today of what we can reimagine. This was a world of high growth, low inequality, no financial crisis, where productivity increases fed into wage increases, where the rich were taxed at very high rates, and yet it was a very strong, cohesive society. And so we have lost, our moral imagination has faded, but we have this relatively recent history, and that's the reality that can create the possibility.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I think that's also the spirit that I'm approaching this with. It's like, hey, actually, we've done many of those things before. It's not like we need to become different human beings or needs to have this or that technology of some sort. It actually does require what you're talking about. Or maybe just the visibility of these solutions at scale, right? So Laura, Tony, whoever wants to go first, but you have been working on those issues and reimagining the economy in different ways through your careers, storied careers. And maybe, Laura, you want to start, just share in a nutshell, what is sort of your pathway to working on moral revolution, but also other things? Yeah. And then Tony.
Yeah, it's a journey full of twists and turns, I would say. Just like Tony, we were both trained as economists. So I studied economics in undergrad, and I studied economics at the cusp, like between the 90s and the early 2000s, I would say, like sort of peak era of neoliberal orthodoxy. And I bought into a lot of that thinking at the time because, you know, I didn't know better. I was a young student at university. There was, I still remember like one lecture in my first macroeconomics course where an invite, with, by the way, taught by Benedetto Gui, who's one of the Italian economists that is known in the civil economy circles. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But he was teaching a very sort of traditional macroeconomics class. But he did invite a speaker during that class. This must have been my freshman or sophomore year or something like that. I was very young. And that speaker talked about the idea of what we measure in the economy and our fixation with gross domestic product, GDP, sort of these measures of growth that does not take into consideration the way that we interact with nature. And we don't really count, for example, all the resources that we extract and destruct in an appropriate way. And so that's kind of like got that bug in me thinking about these topics. And that was interesting. And so then I progressed in my studies and I started focusing on some areas of the markets that are not exactly perfect in the way that the orthodoxy teaches you. I focused on energy markets and power markets in particular. And I really started thinking, I did my PhD in a discipline of economics that's called industrial organization. And it's really thinking about the way that markets or like industries organize themselves and like whether markets markets serve a purpose or not. So that was sort of like my first foray. I started my career in the power sector and really started thinking about, okay, this is a sector that is going to transform. Climate policy came into focus. The European trading scheme on carbon emissions started. And so companies had to start thinking about how that would affect their investments. So that's sort of like how I launched into my exploration at the nexus of energy and climate, actually. So I had a deep expertise in energy markets and power in particular, sort of focusing on climate. I went and worked in philanthropy and I did a bunch of other things. I ended up at Columbia, which is where I met Tony, actually, in 2015. So I did a lot of work on this topic around, okay, if we want to contain climate change within reasonable limits, what's the set of policies and technologies that we need to have in place so that we make sure that that happens? And so I've worked that from different angles, but it's broadly speaking, these decarbonization scenarios, right, that people talk about. And so after doing all that work in 2015, and that really fed directly into the Paris Agreement process, I really felt at the time that, all right, like we kind of had most of the answers. And honestly, it's the same answers a decade later. And this is not rocket science. We know what should happen in order for the world to be on track to try and contain climate change within limits that we consider safe, which is that increasing global average temperatures of no more than 2 degrees Celsius in 2100 above pre-industrial averages, so pre-1850. But what I thought was interesting at the time, again, this is the end of 2015, was that we didn't really have the tools to think about how capital markets would be cooperating or in favor or against the realization of that vision. And so I thought that that was going to be the next intellectually interesting topic to explore. So I shifted more towards finance. I ended up working on Wall Street at a large asset manager, the largest asset manager in the world. And never would I have thought when I was an economics student, because I was more interested in political economy and industrial economics, but ended up in finance. Again, like one of those things you don't expect. And I was one of the first people hired on Wall Street to really think about how do we bring that lens of climate-related risks into our investments? How do we think about that? How do we price that stuff in, right? It was still very much within the framework of economic orthodoxy. And so, which, I mean, by then, 2015 is also the year that Pope Francis issued Laudato Si, and we talk about it in our podcast. It's actually a very foundational document, obviously for the world, but also for me personally. It sort of brought into focus the fact that what I always thought, which is that addressing environmental issues and climate in particular was a moral responsibility for humanity, not just a technical thing to deal with. That was, for me, that connected those two things very well. And it gave sort of like the motivation for my career, like a different and heavier, I think, meaning. So anyways, I end up on Wall Street and I keep doing this stuff from within the system. And we invent this sort of like new space that now it's a really dreaded acronym of ESG, like environmental, social and governance style of investing. It's a way of really thinking about how do you produce better risk adjusted returns if you consider all these different things, right? Like how environmental risks and social risks and governance risks impact your portfolio. And so we did all that. And for a few years, that was great and successful. And we got a lot of capital to move in that direction. And I think in some ways, I think that was a good story. From the perspective of traditional economists, it was a good story because it was about more efficient pricing and more efficient allocation of resources, right? But a couple of years ago, I just came to a point where I was like, this is not enough. I just don't think it's enough. I just don't think that this framework of better allocating capital according to these like risk tools, analytics that we came up with is sufficient. And so I came back to that idea that what's the moral responsibility? And I sort of became fixated with a couple of things. And in particular, is there a way that our Christian tradition can also contribute to making the world move forward? This is something that a lot of us have in common. Even in a very divided society, a lot of Americans describe themselves as Christians. It's obviously fewer than many years ago, but it's more than 60% of the people here. And find me another thing where we have 60% of the people agreeing on something, right? So this is an interesting, I think, entry point. And how can we make that a compelling story? I came back to this idea that people react to narratives, not really to analytics, which, you know, in my head, this is hard to understand, but I feel like we've rationalized this thing left, like we've exhausted all the angles. People don't react to this. Even if you tell them, if we don't do it, it's worse for the economy, still they don't react to it. So what do we need to bring in that conversation? So I sort of went back to the drawing board and started thinking about this. So anyways, long story short, I ended up at Princeton Theological Seminary and I'm studying theology and ecology there, sort of that intersection, which is really interesting and rich. And then I decided with Tony, finally, now that it was not in corporate America anymore, that we could do this podcast, which we call Moral Revolution. And it's about this idea of reclaiming moral land in our society and in the way that we talk about big topics in our politics and in our economics. And so we're doing that, and we're kind of like, we're breaking down these topics and these big conversations and some of our ideas. I really think that there is a huge need for imagination in the world. That's why I come back to this. There's a huge need for imagination. We feel stuck oftentimes. We think that the world we have today is unchangeable. This is what we have, and we're, you know, we just got to live with it. But no, no, absolutely not. I think there's so many interesting people that have written about it, where, you know, I'm just like playing that drum, but it's many, many smarter people than me, from David Graeber to Willie Jennings, and Jennings as a theologian, Graeber as an anthropologist. So many people have talked about this idea that we can imagine something different. And so part of that is a recovery of different alternative ways of thinking about economics as a way that we organize ourselves as a society. And so I talked about the civil economy, but ecological economics, or the well-being economy, or donut economics, and sort of recovering all these. Many of these different traditions have Christian roots, which is also really interesting. And so how do we combine this in a way that makes sense to build a democratic pluralist society and economy? And so that's sort of like what I'm working on right now. I hope that wasn't too long.
Great. Thank you, Laura. Tony, Your pathway and journey.
Okay. Well, so I studied economics as an undergraduate at Trinity College Dublin. And then I came to Columbia University in New York to do my PhD in the early to mid 1990s. And I was very much trained in the standard neoclassical economic tradition, which gave rise to very neoliberal policy prescriptions. And I certainly had bought into that paradigm because it was what I was trained in. It was what I knew. And then in 1998, I went to work at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund in Washington, stayed there for 20 years, was an economist working on numerous countries. I was in the fiscal affairs department. And for a good chunk of it, I was the speechwriter to the managing director, mainly Christine Lagarde at the time. But, you know, like Laura, I felt that something was missing. And for me, the first crisis came with the global financial crisis, because I saw that economists were thinking solely in terms of technocratic approaches and technocratic solutions. But to me, this was a fundamental moral crisis driven by some extremely unethical financiers who made decisions with zero regard for how this was going to affect ordinary people. And when 10 million lost their jobs and another 10 million lost their homes, they walked away with their bonuses and their jobs in a financial sector whose business model barely even changed. That made me furious. And that made me realize that something was profoundly wrong with the neoliberal world that we had grown to inhabit. So after that, I decided that I wanted to do something different. So in 2015, I went back to Columbia University to work for Jeff Sachs. And that's how I met Laura in 2015. Oh. I worked with Jeff on an initiative called Ethics in Action for Sustainable Development. This was housed at the Pontifical Academy for Social Sciences at the Vatican, with the support of Pope Francis. And it brought together leaders and scholars from all the different major religious traditions in the world, plus economists and activists and business and labor people, philanthropists, all kinds of people. And the question we posed ourselves was, can we come up with a shared moral foundation for the huge challenges that we face in the world today? And each meeting we would take one challenge. And what I found remarkable was that even though all of these different traditions have different theologies and different emphases, when it comes to our global economic and social and political challenges, they all came to very similar conclusions. They all emphasized the dignity of every human person, They all emphasize that we have a shared common good, meaning that we are all in it together, not out for individual maximization of preferences, as neoclassical economics would put it, and that we all have a shared responsibility to protect our common home. So this was the foundation of Ethics in Action. We produced a book based on that, and we've had a number of follow-up initiatives at the Vatican on various different topics. But following that, I realized I couldn't just go back to being an IMF economist after that experience. So in 2020, I left the IMF and I wrote a book called Cathonomics, How Catholic Tradition Can Create a More Just Economy, in which I argued that actually Catholic social teaching is not only relevant theologically for Catholics, but also offers a paradigm and a framework for how to restructure our global economy along the lines I just discussed, on dignity, on the common good, and on care for our common home. It's a tradition that's been built up since 1891 by a succession of popes. It's very sophisticated, it's cohesive, it's comprehensive, it's deeply rooted in a philosophical tradition, more deeply rooted, by the way, than neoclassical economics is. So I thought that that would be a good thing to offer to the world. So I wrote that book in 2020. Following that, I am currently working on a new book. It's on the intersection of economic justice and democracy. I want to argue that democracy is strongest when you have economic justice, namely that you have economic security, a decent standard of living, and an equitable distribution of income and wealth for all people. When you have those conditions, you get good democracy, as we had during the 30 golden years. When you don't have those conditions, as during the interwar years, you get fascism and Nazism. Or today, you get the rise of the far right, you get Trumpism. So we're unfortunately seeing history repeating itself, and I would argue it's because we have lost the roots in the economic common good. So that's pretty much my journey, and that brings it up to date as to where I am today. Thanks, Michael.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I see a picture of you and Pope Francis in the background there.
Yes.
That's fantastic. And Laudato Si is sort of, Laura, you said a meaningful document to you personally, and has been for both of you personally. And you mentioned the tradition that it's sort of rooted in and developed as. And I think the current Pope is sort of building on that, taking his name as the sort of successor or portmanteau of the then Pope with the encyclical Reo Novarum, I think, right?
Yes.
It was called, right?
Leo XIII.
So I maybe just a quick plug, the humanistic management approach is basically a managerial approach, not an economic approach, a managerial approach where the protection of dignity and the promotion of well-being is that, I think, Tony, what you're mentioning is actually a commonly shared universalist
yes.
approach to what works. It's not even moral. It is moral, of course, yeah. if you go deep into it, but it's actually functional. It's like, hey, if you don't do it, you get the kind of dysfunction that we're now seeing at all levels, right? So planetary destruction, the social fabric is deteriorated, people are scared, and in some way we're sort of tending towards collective suicide, right? And so that is certainly not the logic of life, and I think all of us are feeling that in some way. So there is definitely a better reality that we can imagine, but that we have also lived through and that we are basically the product of, right? With all the kind of turns and twists and learnings and non-learnings. So your work on the moral revolution, do you want to just go into that? What are some of the things that you have as an ambition for that work? And maybe it feeds into other work that you want to do, because I think we're on a similar path. So just like exploring that, weaving that together, what are your takes? Maybe Tony, you start and then Laura.
Yeah, I mean, we came up with the term moral revolution because, you know, we hear the term political revolution from Bernie Sanders. We hear the term economic revolution. But from our perspective, what is needed is a regrounding of our economy in morality. Kind of like we had during the social democratic era, which kind of remarkable but forgotten, is that politicians of that era used moral language. They would say, this is right, this is wrong, this is fair, This is unfair. Mm. This is just. This is unjust. Now we've completely lost that language. Now it's, is this efficient or is it inefficient? Does it bend the cost curve? It's a dry technocratic language. And it's no surprise that electorates are just turned off by that approach. That we are moral animals. We're political animals. We're moral animals. We respond to that. So what Lara and I want to do is we want to explore, you know, we have, we take many different topics. We talk about Catholic social teaching. We talk about Laudato Si, but we also talk about the various examples in history of when we did things wrong and when we did things. So, you know, we have no set agenda. We just kind of discuss topics that are of interest to us. And we also interview lots of interesting people who are working in this space.
Fantastic. Laura.
Yeah. I would say everything that Tony said so eloquently, as always. And I think for us, I go back to that quote. I know it's strange for given our conversation to throw out a quote by Milton Friedman, but I think that it's actually a really good quote. And he said that only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. And when that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. And I think about that, and I think about how successful that has been as a strategy for some of the ideas that came out, actually, of that intellectual school. And so our attempt is to make sure that other ideas, different ideas, ideas that we think are better, superior, that would produce more equitable outcomes, more well-being and happiness and just like a generally healthier society, we want to make sure that those ideas are the ones lying around. I think we all agree that we could qualify our times, the times that we live in, as times of crisis. There's certainly volatile times. There's successions of crisis. They often happen at the same time. It's this ugly term, polycrisis, but it's really true. We're finding ourselves in this very complicated, disjointed, fragmented, volatile world. And what Tony and I are trying to do is we're trying to put out some ideas that we hope others will also take on, explore, develop, or perhaps build movements around. And so we just want to make sure that those ideas get the time and the sunlight that they deserve. That's, I think, important. As Tony said, we don't have a particular agenda. I mean, I think that our agenda is more intellectual. There's many things that interest us. We meet a lot of really interesting people that have interesting ideas, that have written and talked about and developed interesting ideas. We would like to give some space to those ideas. And I'll give you an example just to give you sort of the range of diversity of the people we interviewed. I'll give you a couple. So typically the way this works is like we meet somebody or we hear somebody talk or presenting some work and we're like, that is super interesting. And I think like we should give some space to that on the podcast. That's what we did. So one of the people we interviewed, for example, on the podcast is Silvia Federici. She is a philosopher, certainly a Marxist philosopher. And she's one of the theorists and activists that started and built the Wages for Housework campaign in the 1970s. This is a type of feminism that not many have heard about. It was a type of feminism that was about caring for the work that women do within the home and advancing this idea that that work should be compensated. It was a really interesting movement, but it kind of got drowned out by a different strand of feminism, which was more about the idea that women should be treated equally in the workplace, have the same professional opportunities that men have, and sort of working on equal pay and equal treatment and all those kinds of things in the workplace. So it was a little bit different, right? It's this idea of saying there are many, many women in the world who do a lot of care work. They care for the workers, they care for their husbands, they care for the children, the future workers. It's a very Marxist worldview, if you will. It was a really interesting campaign that had a lot there that was morally really interesting. And so we interviewed her. And then we also interview theologians on our podcast, Catholic theologians, Elizabeth Johnson, who's a colleague of yours at Fordham. She's just a phenomenal theologian that has written a lot at this intersection of ecology and theology, really thinking about this idea of what does it mean that God incarnated as a human. It's this idea of like really blurring the lines between the biological world and the spiritual world in a way that is just beautiful. She's phenomenal. We interviewed a Brazilian liberation theologian. We interviewed somebody who does work in the post-growth, the growth space. So not necessarily all ideas that we agree with, but ideas that I think need to be explored more deeply and taken more seriously. And so that's sort of what we do.
Fantastic, fantastic. So, yeah, so I mean, what I'm sensing, even though you say there is no agenda there, the agenda is to show alternative realities,
yeah,
possibilities, and yeah, get those ideas into the conversation that currently is so strapped off imagination, right? And I think that is really what we can do as intellectuals, but also you're at the interface in your experience, both in finance and policy, where you may have an audience where you can get people that are decision makers in the current framework now to help them think differently and bolder and beyond the traditional framings that are so unreflected and underreflected. So anyway, that to me makes a lot of sense. I'm curious, like, how, if at all, you are working with those worlds that you basically come from, I will say, like at finance, right? Finance is, I think, one of the key things that needs to transform, where the alternative realities and possibilities need to be explored with way more intensity. Same economic policy, IMF or something. See, I mean, I'm curious to hear, Tony, your take on that. Those were the institutions that created post-World War II crisis. What do you see beyond those institutions? What's working, what's not working? And what are the institutions that we're missing? I'm curious what your take is, like in terms of imagination. What are the... And Tony, I remember in our conversations earlier, you mentioned like, okay, there's a G20. What about an E20? What about a global conversation around the ethics of how we're treating, what we consider right, what we consider wrong? And that used to be the standard dialogue, right? For a long time in humanity, for better or worse, right? With ideologues declaring they have the truth and everything else not necessarily being acceptable. But the quality and the right and wrong, the moral language, was a long time the standard for our general conversations in policy. And now, as you're saying, it has become efficiency, effectiveness, sort of technocratic. And I believe there was a benefit to that intentionally at some point where, okay, let's remove the moralistic and moral language that can be constraining. And so how can we integrate it again in a way that it doesn't become ideology, right? And exclusive. So any response, Laura, Tony, whoever?
Go ahead.
Yes. There's a lot of questions in there. So I completely agree. I think that the risk is that the one that you're pointing to, which is the risk of descending into moralism. And that's sort of the opposite of what we're advocating for, in fact. I think that our premise is that, as Tony said, humans are moral beings and that everything's political. That's the other premise. Literally everything's political. It's just a very basic definition of the term. Everything's political because we are also social beings and we organize ourselves in societies and we all live together and we're simply deciding what rules we live by, right? And that's really what a polis is at the end of the day. So we're political beings and we're moral beings. And at the same time, I mean, I go back to that critique of economics where human beings are viewed as single atoms. It's a completely individualistic view. We're all detached from one another. There's no sense of community and relationality. That's already a completely ridiculous assumption, just given we're talking about human beings. I mean, we're not talking about rocks, right? So that's already a crazy assumption. It's the political assumption. But the other one is that we can strip a sense of moral thinking and ethical thinking, and we just defer to the markets as the ultimate moral arbiter. And that's also crazy because markets are nothing else than a way for people to react to some kind of information. It's not the way that we shouldn't defer to them to think about how we organize ourselves as a society. Markets are not morally neutral, in fact, right? That's the point. But we've decided somehow to pretend like they are. So I think that this is sort of the premise. And at the same time, the types of experience, when Tony and I talk about some of the models that we have observed that different societies and countries have adopted historically, for example, social democracy or Christian democracy in the post-war period, I think that those are periods of time that we think, or we elevate in the conversation because they were based on principles of democracy, of pluralism, of the promotion of human dignity, all those principles that I think we agree are fundamental principles about how we organize ourselves as a society, or at least should be part of that conversation. And so that's what we do. It's definitely not the moralism. And in fact, what I would like what I think we're trying to do is to really inject nuance in moral conversations also, because there's a lot of tendency to just think of everything in black and white. And I think a lot of the world is way more complicated than binary. It's not a binary world. It's a world full of gradations of color. And that's just the way it is. But we've lost the ability to have those nuanced conversations. So that's what we're trying to do with Moral Revolution. I think to your question around, do we engage with the world and the institutions? And I'll let Tony take the one around what institutions should we have and how some of the multilateral institutions that were created in the post-world order have failed to create a world that I think lives by the high standards of some of our ideals. But I'll talk about our engagement with the real world. And certainly in the work that I do, and besides being a student, I also work with different companies and startups related to my previous work when I was in finance. So in particular, as I have expertise, for example, on a few things like how to think about environmental related risks and how to devise tools and analytics and models that can bring those into the way that we think about our portfolios and pursue better risk adjusted returns. So I do some of that work, but expanding it from climate more to nature as like a bigger container of that. And so it's not just climate, which is a component, but it's also ecosystem integrity, it's biodiversity, it's water issues, etc. And sort of thinking more holistically about nature as this world that we're embedded in and that our companies are embedded in, and how do we bring it in? Not think of it as like an external thing to our economy, but really bring it into the way that we think about our economy and we interact with the world. And so that's one thing that I'm doing. And I'm also doing work with investors that take more of a values-oriented lens. So think about faith investors, for example. They approach investing from a perspective that's a little different than maximizing risk-adjusted returns. It adds this layer of saying there are certain things that, because of my values, I just don't want to be invested in. And so how do you do that? How do you, for example, translate all this beautiful Catholic social teaching that Tony has talked about into systematic rules around designing an index for Catholic investors, for example? So I do some work on that front as well. I talk about this work as work that deals with the economy that we have and with the system that we have and tries to do the best we can within the world that we have today, because that's the immediate need. And I think of Moral Revolution and the work that I do at Princeton Theological Seminary and sort of more the intellectual work as really more imagining the economy and the world that we want. And how do we get from here to there? And that's sort of how I think about these two different worlds that I inhabit and the many different roles that I take. But it's very embedded in the practice in today's world. And it's also really imagining something different.
Wonderful. Tony.
Okay. I can talk a little bit about the institutions because, you know, I'm pretty familiar with some of them anyway. You know, the IMF and the World Bank were founded in 1944. Under the Bretton Woods system, which was a core part of the social democratic era. People forget that. This was an era of largely closed capital accounts. There was very little capital mobility. The world was kind of like what China is today, which lets very little capital in and lets very little capital out. What that does is, that has a number of benefits. First of all, you reduce your incidence of financial crises. Second thing it does is it allows governments to direct savings towards productive areas, as Japan, Korea, and China have done it at their various stages of development. And the third thing it does is it curbs the power of the very rich who do not have a veto over taxes and social legislation. Because today we say, well, you tax me, I'm leaving. I don't like this legislation. I'm going to Dubai. I'm going to Switzerland. I'm going somewhere else. That was not really possible during the post-war era because the capital accounts were pretty much restricted. And it's mind-boggling to me that when we see populists today criticizing the free movement of goods, as in trade, criticizing the free movement of people as in migration, but saying nothing about the free movement of capital, which is by far the most damaging, harmful, of the three freedoms under this kind of liberal model. And in my view, that was why the post-war era worked so well, and the IMF was very much part of that. Now, in 1997, the IMF came very close to changing its Articles of Agreement, that's its charter, to push for an open capital account in all its members, which was a complete reversal of what it stood for during the post-war era. And the point I'm making here is that the IMF and the World Bank, after the 90s, became captured by neoliberalism. Part of this was the major shareholders, especially the United States, came under the dominance of free market neoliberals. But also because the economists that were staffing the institutions were trained in this neoliberal way. So it was all they knew. So, you know, this is kind of what happened. Let me give you one more example of kind of this institutional incoherence. In 1948, we were supposed to set up an institution called the International Trade Organization. This would have been about trade liberalization, but it would have put trade in the service of full employment and economic development. It would have allowed a major government role in the economy, and it would have been one member, one vote for all countries. The United States Senate said, no way. This sounds like a socialist institution. We are not endorsing this. So the International Trade Organization was killed before it could even be born. 1995, the World Trade Organization was founded. This was a very different animal. This was pro-corporate from day one. It was based on international arbitration panels that would override what democratic governments wanted to do and say. Instead of being about slow and steady tariff reductions as took place in the 30 golden years, it was now about things like capital account liberalization, regulatory harmonization, internet property protection, and worst of all, investor-state dispute resolution mechanisms whereby investors could sue governments on the grounds that whatever tax or regulations you're introducing has a negative effect on my profits. I can sue you for that. This is what international organizations have become. This is not what they were during the 30 golden years. During the 30 golden years, they were really about the common good, the international common good. They put labor ahead of capital, and they put the common good ahead of profits. So I think, you know, institutions got a little bit lost since 1980.
In many ways, their failure is what we are seeing right now. And I think Kofi Annan at one point in 2001, I remember a statement where he's saying, globalization works either for everyone or it doesn't work for nobody.
Right. Yeah.
And we are seeing that design of those global institutions that were supposed to be this, you know, Catholic in the original sense, universalist approach to organizing, stewarding humanity, were so much set up into failing those basic principles of protecting the dignity and promoting the common good so that it serves these few billionaires, gazillionaires, and still is, right? And so everybody is suffering from that. I would argue even those that quote unquote benefit materially, they're scared, right? Yeah. They're scared. They have their bunkers. They need to go into space or something, right? Because, yeah, of course, who wants to be social with them unless they're in a power structure dependent on them, right? So that's really, I think, massive design failure. So you're thinking about the alternatives. You're working on, Laura, you're saying within the system corrections, but also sort of outside the system's new designs of sort. What are some of the key things that give you hope right now? Grounded hope, not just like, oh, okay, nebulous kind of ambitions.
Yeah.
But what are some of the things, and maybe Tony for you too, is like, where your grounded sense of hope, if you have it, reside or is nourished?
Yeah, it's sometimes it feels difficult to find hope in the world that we live in. I think we all like open our newspapers or phones or whatever we get our information from in the morning, and it's just something bad after something else and something else. It seems really hard. But I do have hope, and I think I'm just going to throw out a few things. The first thing I'll say is that there have been several surveys that have showed that there's a lot of openness, even in the types of environments, say like the corporate world or the finance world, or two different ideas. There's a lot of openness to that. There's actually ideas such as, for example, a study by the London School of Economics has polled people around this idea of degrowth, which also has a terrible word, right? It just sounds like you're getting poor or something like that. And the reaction is actually negative about the word, but positive about all the stuff that that word contains in terms of the policies and the policies that would go with that under that umbrella. And so that's really interesting, I think. There's also been other surveys that have showed that people think that environmental issues are really important, but they kind of lose hope that anybody else around them thinks the same thing. And so if only we could connect these voices, I think that there could be a big possibility for social change in a much bigger way than today. And I think that part of the reason why this isn't happening at the scale that we need is, again, because of this atomized society where we're all like individuals in their own little bubble trying to survive. And we just don't think as a community. So I think that that's a big shift that should happen somehow. I'm hoping to figure out how to make it happen. But there's hope because there's a lot of people that are really ready for something different. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with the status quo, and they recognize that there are big issues and they're really open to the kinds of solutions that Tony and I and you know, and people we think are better. So that's one thing that gives me hope. A second thing that gives me hope is that even in this world where we're not making enough progress on climate change, certainly not at the scale that we need, but it does feel like, for example, on the energy transition, we've turned a big corner. And that corner has been turned because of policy support in many parts of the world that has made relative tech prices come down dramatically for clean energy solutions, for example. And so last year, the world has invested more than $2 trillion in clean energy investments. And that's the highest number ever. It was also higher than the amount that was invested in fossil fuels last year, in any kinds along the value chain of fossil fuels. So we're really starting to turn the point there. I'll also remind our listeners that the costs of renewable energies has come down over 90% of the last 10 years. It's actually probably 98% for solar. It's about 90-something percent for wind. And it's coming out dramatically, like literally every minute we speak, for batteries and storage. And so the trajectory there is amazing. This is happening. And now energy suppliers are investing in those sources because they are the most economical sources. So something has dramatically shifted in that world. And energy-related emissions are 70% of our emissions in the world today. So addressing this big chunk of emissions is making a big, big step forward in trying to mitigate climate change. Is it enough? No. But the fact that capital markets are doing this, even as policy support for these sources is coming down a lot, I think is very telling. The fact that, as I used to joke in the 2016 to 2020, during the first Trump administration, what hit me really during that time was that even the most powerful politician in the world, the president of the United States, really could not bring coal back at the time. Now, of course, you can argue coal sort of resurrects temporarily at times of crisis like this one, for example, and that's true. But the idea of bringing back coal is ludicrous because the economics don't make sense. And even the president of the United States can't really do much about that, right? And so that, I think, is a really interesting moment that we're in, where really that tide has turned. And I think that's another thing that gives me hope. Is it enough? No. But is it amazing? Yes. And then I think the other thing that gives me hope is that there are many ideas lying around that really deserve more exploration. And that's what we're hoping to do, right? And I'm also hoping that with others, because obviously nobody individually can solve anything. If there's one thing I've learned in theology school is also that it is really let go of that hero complex. But I think if we can find communities and give space and oxygen to these ideas, then the possibilities for change are there.
Thank you, Tony.
Okay, couple of things. One thing that gives me hope is actually the Pope. Pope Francis was an amazing moral leader of the world during his decade in office, leading on, you know, talking about the poor, the excluded, the environment, peace, migrants and refugees. At a dark time, he was a moral leader. And now Pope Leo XIV has very ably stepped into his shoes, and he has now become the world's moral leader. He's speaking out every day against war and calling for an end to violence, especially in the Middle East. And so that's very important. Another thing that gives me hope is the possibility of generational change. Eventually, the gerontocrats and the baby boomers will have to shuffle off the stage, and they will not be able to do any further damage. A new generation will take over, and the evidence suggests that the younger generations are much more aligned with the common good than the older generations were. They will have a lot of hard work to do rebuilding the mess that they were, but I think that they can do it. And I think that, you know, to me, that's a positive sign. We just need a little patience.
Great. Wow. That's powerful. And I think that that resonates. And that's probably a stream, a bundle of hopeful trends that may converge at some point. I think, Laura, you're pointing to it. It's like, it is, we have survived as a species because of collaboration.
Yes.
Right? And so that fundamental sociality that we have actually designed out of our current lives is probably the solution ultimately, right?
Yeah.
So Otto Sharma, if you're familiar with his words, it says, this is the social soil that we need to plant. We're like, we have poor soil. The carbon in the air can actually make soil better through regenerative yes. agriculture, right? And help everything in that sense. But the social soil, the connections, the conversations, the communication between people across this pluralistic ignorance barrier, right? It's like, oh, I'm so different from you. No, we're actually humans. We're very, very, very different. 99.9% of our DNA is even the same, right? And we focus so much on those differences. And that's sort of a lot of the discourse is about, oh, I'm so different. I'm so special. I need more recognition on this, on that. And it's like, yeah, this is sort of a dignity discourse that separates. Whereas if you can bring it together, I think there is simple solutions and just getting people to align. And maybe what you're saying, the ideas that lying around for them to be able to just run with them.
I hope so. And I love that you bring in the soil as a metaphor, because that is a very important thing for me, is really rebuilding that connection that humans, many of us, I'm not saying all humans, of course, there's many humans that understand the soil very well, but so many of us have lost that. And there's so much that we can learn from that. So I love that metaphor. Mm. Thank you for that.
Yeah. And the Vatican has this new sort of regenerative, like Laudato Si Borgo, right? And other places where, the reconnection of our life systems, I think, in our imagination, that is probably a simple solution. Don't want to oversimplify it, but yeah, thank you so much for being on. I want to close this conversation with both of you giving me a number from 1 to 35, and then we'll see what kind of questions Marcel Proust has for you.
Tony, do you want to go first in the lottery?
Okay, 21.
Okay, and then Laura?
I'll do 24.
Okay, so Tony, for you, where would you most like to live?
Where would I most like to live? You know, it would be a choice between Rome and London, but since I have to make one choice, I'll say London because, and don't get annoyed with me, Laura, I'd say Italy would be a very frustrating place to live on a daily basis.
You're absolutely right. Oh my God. I knew how to answer that one. The answer for me is like in some hilly vineyard in central Italy. That's very easy for me to answer that one.
Good, good, good. So yeah, 24, Laura, what is your favorite occupation?
Like how I spend my time?
Maybe, maybe like a professional occupation, something, I don't know.
Well, I have aspirations of becoming a farmer in some way. I have this dream of making my own wine and my own olive oil, this sort of like beautiful bucolic dream. But let's be honest, I don't really have a lot of those skills. I'm trying to build on some of those skills, but I don't have too many. And so I think my favorite occupation is the intellectual occupation. Clearly, I very much enjoy that. So I'm trying to figure out how to combine those two things, the intellectual occupation, but also that sort of touching something that lets me touch the land and do something practical with it.
The soil metaphor in multiple ways.
Oh,
right?
Soil
for ideas, soil for olive oil and wine. Yes. And the social connections. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. By the way, just because I had Sara Roversi on the podcast recently. Are you aware of her work?
A little bit, yes.
Yeah, so she is also working very much with the Vatican and regeneration and food and cities.
Amazing.
In the province of...
I listened to the podcast. Yeah, for sure,
It's in somewhere in southern Italy, like this very regenerative kind of area.
Wow, I would love to talk to her, actually. That's amazing.
That is very interesting with regard to soil and all the other things.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both, Tony, Laura, for being here. I know you have to leave at the top of the hour, but I appreciate our time together and hope to continue this.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
This is great.
A pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Laura. Ciao, ciao.
Bye-bye.